And I says, because I'm an alcoholic, and I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime? And she said, yes, and we traded phone numbers. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. So the next day, I took Kay to a meeting, and I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. And Kay didn't stay sober at that time. But I did. And I learned what it said in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it says that when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. I didn't even know at that point that in my mind all that was going on was it's all failing. You know. Today, though, Kay is sober. On August 3rd, I believe she's going to celebrate, I think it's 14 continuous years of sobriety. And she has every bit as much to do with my being in Alcoholics Anonymous today as I had to do with her being here. I went on and I had some other, you know, dating kind of experiences. I found, though, you know, as I look back on my life, I started to realize that I was having a little problem with having a relationship, and a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous kind of explained part of the problem. You see, I was the kind of person that I really wanted to have a relationship, but this is kind of the way I would relate to a guy. I meet a guy, and this is how what I do. I think, I don't need you. I don't care whether you live or die. It makes no difference to me whether you stick around or not, okay? All right. Now, what I was really thinking was, you know, as soon as he says, I love you and I can't live without you, then I'm going to say, me too. See? And then we'll be happy. The funny thing is, is the one you kind of meet and go out with people and you tell them, I don't need you. I could care less if you live or die, and it makes no difference to me whether you're around or not. They hardly ever say, I love you and I can't live without you. It's really bizarre how that hardly ever happens, you know. Anyway, I went to law school after I'd been there a little while. I got asked out by this guy. And you know, I mean, it was just silly. He was a nice Jewish boy from Chicago. He had no tattoos. He'd never even been to jail, let alone prison. You know, why would I go out with him? And we've been going out one day at a time for the last 8 years. After we started, we've been dating for, just a couple of months, and he came home with two tickets to Chicago. He's from a very large family. And he wanted to take me home because he wanted to introduce me to the people that mattered the most in his life, because he was so proud of me. So proud of what Alcoholics Anonymous had made me. And I couldn't help but think at that time, and when I went back to meet his family, how when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my own family wouldn't even let me in their doors, not for a long, long time. I was well over 5 years sober before I was ever allowed in their home. I think I was closer to 10 years sober before I was allowed to have any kind of keys. Our life is not, it's not perfect, as we've gone out, but it's been the best relationship that I've ever had. It's kind of funny, we were scheduled to get married last November, and right around October, this woman called me up, and I think she was from back in New York. I've never met her. And she called me up because she was in this relationship. Well, she'd been in this relationship and it had just ended. And she was in a lot of pain, and she knew, of course, the reason she was in so much pain was because she knew that this relationship wasn't supposed to end, because this was the right one. You know, this was the only one, and this was the right one. And we talked, and I shared with her the fact that at that time, when I was walking around that schoolyard and I was thinking about killing myself, that this guy that I went out with, I'd been going out with him for about 2 years, and in 2 years he'd never even bought me dinner. Once I think he bought me a taco at Taco Bell. But in 2 years he never even took me out to dinner, and that was the kind of guy that I knew was right for me, you know, and I was gonna kill myself because God took him away, you know, and today I am married to a man who, has taken me to, several different countries to visit. And he takes me out to dinner on a regular basis, and sometimes I take him out to dinner. We have a relationship that he knows that I care about him, and he knows that I love him, and he knows that he matters a lot. And I know the same. And it doesn't mean that, that I'm weak. And it's been such an interesting thing. You know, my sponsor Gail used to try and explain to me over and over and over. She said, June, when are you going to learn that there's a difference between being strong and being tough? You know, that it has nothing to do with the things that you think it does, that your old ideas are all screwed up. And it's taken me many, many years. I'm not sure exactly how long, but it took a lot of years before I really started to see the difference. And today I'm stronger than I have ever been. And the interesting thing about that is that there are more people in the world, in this room, and in a whole lot of others that know that they could hurt my feelings and that they matter in my life. It's a complete paradox to what I thought. I don't want to be tough anymore, and there aren't any tough people in my life. You know, it's not the way that I want to surround my life anymore. I want to tell a couple of other little stories. You know, it's funny coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, the way that I did, and having a couple people tell me that, you know, maybe I didn't really belong and I was too young and things like that. You'd think that I'd be like ultra sensitive and I would never even, it would never even occur to me in my wildest dreams to consider that someone did not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, that's what it seems like it should be to me. And yet that's not the case. I was at the Monday Night Venice group, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, something like that. And we had this guy that was, they were bringing to meetings. His name was Catfish. I mean, that wasn't really his name, but that's what everybody called him. And Catfish was crazy. He was crazy. He'd sit in the front row of the meeting, he'd stick straws up his nose, and he'd grab flies, imaginary flies, and he'd eat them during the meeting. And he was very distracting. Because I always sit in the front row, so it particularly bothered me. And I knew, I mean, this guy, if anybody ever had a wet brain, I mean, this guy was beyond help. And it really irritated me, you know, that he was sitting in the meeting distracting me and the newcomers, you know, with this. And I really didn't think he should be allowed to come to meetings. But I didn't say anything, you know. But I really, that's what I thought. And I just kept going to these meetings, and I'd see him. And, you know, and sometimes, like, he'd ask, you know, people for rides home, and he was just downright scary. You know, I mean, he really was. He was just out of it. And this was a couple years later. I was driving down the street, and I pulled up at a red light, and I looked over at the bus bench, and there was Catfish. And he looked right at me. He saw me. I mean, you know, I had to offer him a ride. He didn't have any straws in his nose or anything. So he gets in my car, and we kind of talked a little bit, and it was kind of weird, you know. Turns out Catfish had a daughter. I mean, can you imagine? I just couldn't believe it, you know. And he wasn't really able to make sentences, you know, but he just said a couple different words and stuff, and I just kind of looked at him kind of, it was just kind of strange. And I guess it's been maybe, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Let's see, that was 10 years ago, so maybe about 7 years ago now. I was sitting in that Westwood meeting. And I was just sitting there. It was the end of the meeting, and they do the birthday cakes out in California at the end. And all of a sudden they said, and tonight we have a cake for 7 years for Walter. And Catfish got up. And Catfish was wearing a navy blue suit and a little yellow tie. He looked kind of like Shipwreck in his conservative days. And he walked up there, and he sounded just like one of my school professors. And I would have kept him out of AA. You know, I wouldn't have thought that he could make it here. I didn't think that that we had anything left to offer him. And so I try and remember that sometimes when I see someone sitting there that I think's gone too far, or hadn't gone far enough, or in the right, you know, quality for our group, something like that. Maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I was walking down the street in Culver City, and saw this little old drunk come walking down the street, and we kind of looked each other in the eyes. We recognized each other, and it was Paul. And Paul and I started talking a little bit, and he was on his way to this pet store with his little bird, Petey. And Petey was the only friend that Paul had. Paul's family wouldn't talk to him anymore, and he lived in this little old drunk hotel. And Paul was telling me that the night before, Petey had been able to almost fly away. And Paul thought he was just going to die if he lost Petey, because that was the only person he had, the only thing he had left to talk to. And Paul and I, we stood there and we talked, and I said, you know, let's go get some coffee. There's this little coffee shop across the street, and we went in and we sat in there. And I ordered coffee and Paul ordered a beer. Probably the only person I could think of that I've known since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous that I thought was an alcoholic that I bought a drink for. And we sat there and we talked. And he asked me what was going on, and I told him that, you know, I was living nearby, and I'd finished school, and I was a lawyer, and he asked if he could see one of my business cards, and I showed him one, and he started crying. And he looked at me, and he said, "You know, I must have taught you really well." And I told him that he had. And isn't it amazing sometimes that the people that teach us the best don't even get the message themselves? I don't know when, you know, whether he'll come in here someday. I hope so. I don't know how some of us get the gift and some of us miss it. I'm not quite sure how that works out. I'm going to tell just one other area of my life a little bit. When I got sober, one of the speakers that talked an awful lot in my area and that I know many of you've heard was Chuck Chamberlain. A lot of what Chuck used to talk about really didn't make a whole lot of sense to me until I was sober quite a while. One of the things I remember him talking about from the very beginning is he would stand up, especially at the Monday Night Venice Group, I remember, and he would say that he got out there and he tried to be of service. He'd get up in the morning, he'd try and get out there, and he'd help God's kids do what they need to have done because he wanted to. And that was kind of what it was all about. That was what his whole 11th step was all about. And then he'd stand up there and he'd say, "And if any of you are sitting out there tonight and you go to work Monday through Friday just to get a paycheck and to have the weekend off, you're cheating yourself and everyone that you come in contact with." And I thought about what he said, and it just made absolutely no sense. And he'd say it again. "If there's anybody out there and they go to work Monday through Friday just to get a paycheck and to have the weekends off, they're cheating themselves and everyone that they come in contact with." And I thought, he's got to be crazy. I mean, first of all, he's got to be rich, too, to say something stupid like that, you know? Because it's all about your paycheck and having the weekend off. I mean, everybody knows that. You drag into work on Monday, it kind of ruins your life for 5 days, and then Saturday you have a fairly good day, Sunday's kind of wrecked because you know you have to go back the next day, and then you sort of, you know, slop through the whole week miserable waiting for Saturday or Friday night again, you know, and getting the paycheck and counting it up and knowing it's never enough because they don't pay you right, you know, as much as you work, and, you know, they've undervalued you. And I just couldn't figure out what he was saying, and I was sober about maybe 8 or 9 years. And I was at the, I was waitressing. And I'd go to work and I'd serve the tables and I'd run in the kitchen and then I'd count up my tips, you know, because you make most of your money on tips, and I'd count up my tips and I think, Jesus Christ, I mean, $5.75. I've been here for 2 hours. How am I going to support myself on this? This is absolutely ridiculous, you know, and then they're like, "Meh, can I have some mustard, horseradish, some sweet and low and more coffee?" You know, and I think, geez. You know, they're going to leave me 50 cents. I can buy a magazine, you know? Anyway, and I'd run back out there, and then I'd work for another hour, and then I'd go back, and I'd count my tips, and I'd know I was never going to make it, and it would just drive me crazy. And all of a sudden, one night, I was back there, and I was counting my tips, and somehow I thought of Chuck, and I thought about what he said, and I thought about the fact that, you know, my whole life was just ruined. It was ruined when I was at work. It was ruined when I wasn't at work, when I was afraid that I had to go back to work. It was ruined on my days off, thinking about going back, you know, and I hardly ever enjoyed my days off, and that whole thing. And I thought about what he said, you know, if you go to work Monday through Friday just to have the time off and your paycheck, you're cheating yourself and everyone that you come in contact with. And then he talked about how he'd get up and he'd just try and get out there and be of service. He'd help God's kids do what they needed to have done because he wanted to. And I thought about that, and I started to go out there, and I started to give those people their food because they needed it. Because they had to have their food so that they could go on, and they could get out there and be of service to God's kids the way that they needed to. And if they needed a little bit of mustard to help them to go out there and be of better service, that was my job. And I was able to get out there and to start to do it. And I'd love to stand up here and say, you know, from then on I made $500 a night instead of $550. That's not true. It does seem like I made maybe a little bit more money, but that isn't really the point. The point was the way that I felt. My time just kind of sailed by. I'd be looking, and everybody else, you know, was looking at their watch about 27 times a night. I'd look at mine, and it was 10 minutes past when I was already supposed to get off, and I absolutely couldn't believe it. And I started to learn what a wonderful, wonderful lesson it was. And today in the job that I have, I'm able to be of service. You know, I work in criminal defense, and I meet a lot of future members of Alcoholics Anonymous while I'm out there. And I meet some that used to be members that aren't right now, and I see where this disease takes them, and I see the progression. and I'm able to be out there and to be of service. And most of the time I go to work Monday through Friday, not just to get my paycheck and to have the weekend off, but to try and be of service. And those are the days that just kind of sail by, and the weeks sort of sail by. And I highly recommend it. Those of you who are working, I don't care where you're working, you take a look around, and I guarantee you that you'll be able to tell just by the looks on the people's faces, the people who are there just to get their paycheck and to have the weekend off, and the people who are there to be of service and because they want to put something into that place that they're working. And I guarantee you which people are having the most fun. It's just as simple as night and day, and I couldn't see it for a long, long time. Kind of like, you know, Ken was sharing, and Chuck used to always say, you can't see it until you can see, and you can't hear until you can hear. I was at work, and I'd been there for quite a while, and a couple years, and I wasn't worried about getting promoted, and I wasn't worried about, you know, rising up and going to the top, because that doesn't work for me. When I get into thinking about competition and what's mine and what I, and what I need and how come they're not recognizing me and things like that, it just makes me miserable and crazy. And so what I do is I just leave that all up to God, and I just show up and try and be of service. And I'd been at work for a couple years, and this boss of mine called me in, and there's about 500 lawyers in the office that I work in, and he called me in and said, you know, June, we got 37 branches that we have out in Los Angeles, and we're going to have to transfer you from the downtown main branch, but I'd like to know which of those places would be the ones that would be the best for you. And if there's any way we can do it, we'd like to try and give you one of those assignments because we're really very happy with you. And I was really touched, you know. I mean, I was really flattered that this guy even, you know, recognized who the hell I was out of all these lawyers. And I told him the two assignments, you know, that would be the best. And one was Inglewood and one was Santa Monica. And Santa Monica would be by far the best because it's the closest to my house, you know. But either one would have been great. And about a week later, I found out that I got Inglewood. And I was very grateful. I was very touched that this man had taken the time to think about where I'd like to go and then had made some arrangements to help me get that assignment out of all the many that I could have gotten. It was just great. Until about 10 minutes later, when I found out about this woman who'd been in the office less time than I had, and she got Santa Monica on the same day. Of course, she just happens to be very close friends with the number two man in our office, you know. And I was really pissed. And I talked to God, and I said, this is not spiritual. You know, I mean, how am I supposed to believe that you're going to take care of everything if it's this who you know and, you know, and how you get where you're supposed to get, you know, because of your parents were best friends with so-and-so. And I thought, you know, I mean, I just can't believe this. I was very disillusioned. And they sent me out to Inglewood, and I was just plain mad, you know, and I had a bad attitude. And I started working out there, and all I could think was, she's in Santa Monica. That's where the beach is. It's close to my house. It's where I'm supposed to be. And I rah, rah, rah. And then, of course, you know, I started thinking. I thought about the Serenity Prayer, and I thought about the things I've been taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, I got a couple choices here. I can leave, and I can go get another job. I have the courage to change that if that's what I want to do. Or I can accept the fact that I'm in Inglewood, and I can be the best attorney that I can be while I'm here and try and be of service. And I decided to go ahead and try and do that. And I went ahead, and I tried to get out there, and I tried to be of service, and I had a wonderful time in Inglewood. I got transferred a few months later back to the downtown office. In the meantime, this woman out in Santa Monica that had my job had a nervous breakdown because the stress was so bad. I got downtown, and they put me in charge of a training program with the new lawyers that were coming into the office. And my boss called me in. This was a different boss, and he called me in, and he said, June, I wanted to let you know, he said, that we brought you back down here because we want you to work with the new lawyers because we love your attitude about work and about, you know, your job. And I thought, oh, my God, let me tell you that there isn't anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972 who ever thought I'd get a job for my attitude, you know. I want to tell you that I believe that all of the answers that I have needed have come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that, and this is all my opinion, as I said in the very beginning, I got a lot of people out in my area that seem to get a few years sober, and it seems to me like instead of working the steps and instead of working the program, they start going to some other different programs and they get a therapist and they get a counselor and they start running around. And, you know, I'm sure every one of us has thought when we hear that line in the book about having grave emotional and mental disorders that we're the one that they meant. I happen to believe that there are very few that they were directing that statement at, and that all of the answers are within the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have found that all of the promises of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous have come true for me. I want to read them to you, and I want to see if I can point out something when I'm done that I never noticed until just about a year or so ago. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. I realized about a year ago when I was reading over those promises that many of them have to do with the fact, not me becoming anything great, not me becoming a better person or liking myself better or things like that really, but me being able to turn my eyes away from myself and get out and be of service and look around and see where I can add something to life. Instead of just calling up my sponsor and seeing what they can give me and how they can make me better, I started to be able to call and just see if maybe I could brighten up their day. You know, maybe I could just add a little bit to their life. And that's what I've been able to try and do. I can't believe it. I came into this program as much a taker as anybody that I've ever seen. And in the years that I have been here, I have learned that the way of life that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer has taught me to be able to give. And then on the days that I'm able to do that and to turn my eyes away from me, those are the happiest days that I've ever had. I told you about how I hated myself and how I didn't like myself and how I couldn't look in a mirror. And I'm going to share one or two other stories with you about that, and then I'm sitting down. I went to a convention when I was about 5 years sober in Palm Springs, and I was looking around the room comparing myself to everybody else in the room, as I always had done and still very often do. And as I looked around the room, you know, I was wearing this long brown dress. I looked around the room and I saw this beautiful, I think it was a black dress, and I thought, wow. I mean, don't you wish you were wearing that gorgeous black dress? And I said, no. I thought, what do you mean no? I talked to myself. What do you mean, no? No, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I looked around, and I think I saw a green dress, and green's my favorite color. And I said, don't you wish you were wearing that green dress? And I thought, nope, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I absolutely could not believe it. And then I started asking myself other questions. And I realized for the first time in my life, right then, right there, I wanted to have red curly hair. I wanted to be tall and skinny. I wanted to be wearing my dress. I wanted to be sitting at the table that I was sitting at. I absolutely couldn't believe it. And more important than all of that, and that's very important for someone who came from where I came from, I didn't want to feel like anybody else. I didn't want to be living anyone else's life. And I'd love to be able to tell you that since that day, from the time I was about 5 years sober till then, I've never wanted to do or be anything else but me. That's not true. There's a lot of days I'd rather be blonde or stacked, you know? But most of the time, I like who I am and what Alcoholics Anonymous has made me. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972, there wasn't anyone here that could have told me that someday I wouldn't want to trade places with anyone else in the whole world. And in November of last year, I got married. And I had a wedding that is the best wedding that I've ever been to. And I had a dress that was the most beautiful dress that I've ever seen in my life. And I was the most beautiful woman that I've ever known at that particular moment. And it took me days to find the right kind of shoes. You know, I mean, I didn't even wear shoes when I got here. And what was the most special probably about that is that every member of my family came from many different states to be there. And two of my grandparents are both dead, but a brother from each of their families came from Canada. They'd never been to the United States, but they came to represent that part of my family and to be with me on that day. And there wasn't anyone in my family that would have driven the 5 miles from Culver City to Venice when I got sober in 1972. I don't know how these things happen. You know, I gotta tell you, I mean, There's no way I would have planned these things. You know, Ken was talking about the reality surpassing his wildest dreams. I'm going to let you know that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any dreams. I didn't want to be anything. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to grow up and be something. I just wanted to die, and I couldn't do it. And I stuck around here. And after I'd been sober for a while, they gave me some dreams. And then some of the people that came before and some of the people that have come after me, they've stood around me and in front and behind and on my sides, and they've helped some of those dreams come true. And what I want to let you know is if you're sitting there and you're new and you don't have any dreams, stick around and we'll find you some. And if you've been around for a while and you're sitting there and you're sure that your dreams are never going to come true, maybe they're not. Maybe we're going to find you some different ones, but please don't give up before the miracle happens in your life. Thanks again for letting me be part of it.